This is The Allusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, hold language in my arms and say, there, there, it's all right, while secretly crossing my fingers behind its back. Coming up in today's show, crushing news for pedants. To warm up, here's some word history. I received the following email from Rose. Hello, Helen. I am five. We are learning computers. Why is it called login at the start? Firstly, Rose, congratulations upon being so competent at emails at such a young age. Now, strap in, because this explanation sounds like a lie, but apparently really isn't. The first known written example of login in the computer sense is from 1963, when computing was in its infancy. But in the sense of entering information, log had already been in use for nearly 300 years, stemming from sailors logging information into a ship's logbook. And why that book was called a log was because of the way they ascertained the ship's speed. They'd throw a log overboard attached to a long line of rope with knots tied along it, and as the ship moved away, the log would stay floating roughly in the same place, but they'd let the rope unspool for a fixed amount of time. By counting the knots that ran overboard, they'd measure the distance travelled, divide it by the time, and thus calculate the speed, which they then logged in the logbook. Hence also why the unit of measurement for ship speed is the knot. On with the show! I get asked a lot of questions about the English language, and most of them can be boiled down to this. Why is English such an idiosyncratic mess? And why has nobody tried to sort it out? Well, some people have kind of tried. For hundreds of years, English had been a swirling concoction of Latin, German, and French, thanks to all the invasions of Britain, and then there were tons of words that English had nicked from other languages, and the whole lot was refusing to behave regularly or obey rules consistently. And to top it all, it's riddled with silent G's. 300 or so years ago, some people decided they had had enough. Even though they'd had a couple of hundred years to get used to it, they were still reeling from the aftershock of the Renaissance.
If you think of the Renaissance, it's a period of with a large number of broad-ranging changes in many domains.
That's Thomas Goddard, who I interrupted finishing off his PhD in the history of linguistic ideas.
And the language all of a sudden evolves very rapidly. There's a great number of new words borrowed from French, but also from Latin and Greek. There's also, with the advent of printing, the standardization of the spelling. The printers had to agree on how to spell the words. So there's a general feeling around the 17th century that there's too much uncertainty about the language, that there are too many competing forms, too many competing spellings, too many competing structures, and that there is a need to what they call ascertain. This is what Swift calls it in his proposal, to ascertain the language, to agree on what the correct form of the language.
Jonathan Swift is better known for A Modest Proposal, one of the most famous satires in English, in which he suggested Irish paupers might improve their finances by selling their children to the rich to eat. There was significantly less comedy cannibalism in his 1712 proposal for correcting, improving, and ascertaining the English tongue. But he did echo the sentiment of several of his fellow authors and grammarians at the time. Why not appoint an official body of experts to reform and regulate the English language, along the lines of what the French language already had? The Académie Française.
It was formed in 1635 by Cardinal Richelieu, who was a very important person in the 17th century, very politically important.
Dr. Liv Walsh is an expert in linguistic purism.
Its aim was, I guess, to keep the French pure. There was this idea in the 17th century that French had reached this state of perfection, and it needed to be kept in that state, and that any changes to it at that time were seen very negatively because it was seen as being so perfect.
The Académie Française was based on the world's first language academy, founded in 1583, the Italian Academy, the Accademia della Crusca, which translates as the Academy of Bran, as in Bran, Bran Flakes Bran.
There's loads of metaphors when you're talking about purism, you know, choking weeds, you know, weeds choking the language, you need to pull them up, or a disease attacking the language, or, you know, something contaminating the language. And I think the idea of bran is that the wheat will be separated from the bran, so you'll want to keep it pure.
The Académie Française has 40 members, known as the Immortels, because once you're a member, you're a member until death. And it's still going today, even though it hasn't always had a smooth ride.
Through the French Revolution, it might have been suppressed during the French Revolution, but would have come back into being like immediately afterwards. Because one of the really important ideas of the revolution was that everybody should speak a common language, and that common language should be French. So the Académie Française would have been important, because at the time of the revolution, there were so many people in France who spoke a regional language, and it was very difficult to envisage this unified nation without a single language to unify it. To be honest, in the 17th century, there was still a huge amount of the population in what we now consider France, in that geographical area didn't speak French at all. They would have spoken regional languages. The standard French that we know today would have spread from a dialect that was called Francien, which was centred around Paris for social reasons and economic reasons. That's the dialect that eventually spread across France. But, you know, until probably the early 20th century, a really big proportion of people in France wouldn't have spoken what we call standard French now. They would have spoken a dialect.
So really, the Académie Française was catering to a small minority of French speakers, who were likely to be in a high bracket of class, education and wealth. In which case, how do you compel a whole country to get in line and speak the language you've decided is the right one?
There were different means of doing so. Like, it didn't happen all at once. It wasn't like the revolution happened and suddenly everyone started speaking French. But there were a number of political and economic and social factors that led eventually to French becoming widespread, but it would have taken a good century or more after the revolution for that to actually happen. So one of the really important things would have been the introduction of free education. They didn't actually introduce really truly free widespread education until probably the 1880s or so in France. And once children started going to school like that, they always spoke French in school, only standard French, and you were punished if you were caught speaking your local dialect. There would have been different ways of punishing them. I think one of the things they used to do was you'd be given something to hold if you were caught speaking dialect, and then the next child who was caught speaking their local dialect would pass it on to them, and the child at the end of the day who was holding whatever the object was would get a thrashing or would get punished. So they were quite strict about not using your local language.
Once you've got a whole generation speaking in a certain way, it doesn't take long for the other ways to start to die, which in this case, I suppose, is mission accomplished. So how does the Académie Française keep itself busy now? Well, it works on new editions of the dictionary, it gives out prizes, it steps into linguistic debates about such matters as spelling reform or the preservation of gendered job titles, and for the last few years, it has had the right to approve or veto the efforts of the terminology commissions, which was set up in the 1970s in several ministries to create replacements for terms which had crept into French from English. English has poached many terms from French, for example, joie de vivre and je ne sais quoi, because English didn't have its own expressions for those concepts, which is one of the reasons why borrowing from other languages happens. It's an extremely common linguistic process, so French might be fighting a losing battle.
So the English term will enter the language, especially in areas like technology nowadays, just because that's the technology is often coming from English-speaking countries, and the technology comes, the word comes with it, and that's the word they use. And by the time the terminology commissions get around to creating a replacement, often the English term is just in such widespread usage that it would be very difficult to get the French term to take over.
In contrast, the movement to fix the English language was quite keen to make it more like a foreign language, in this case Latin, which they thought was more noble and classier all round.
They wanted to give the English language the same respectability in religious use, in religious practice, or in scholarly practice. And therefore they thought that proper grammar was Latin grammar, and the best way of speaking English was to speak English the way Latin was written, basically.
But English is not Latin. It behaves differently to Latin. Nonetheless, some of the artificial rules they tried to impose continue to stink the place out.
For example, you should not split an infinitive. That's one of those silly rules that are still brought up nowadays, because in Latin you could not infinitive. The infinitive was just one word. It was not composed as in English of a particle and a verbal base. So it's impossible in Latin to spit an infinitive. And therefore, they thought that English should follow the same order, and that the two should not be separated from the verbal base in English as well.
Listeners, I urge you to boldly split infinitives when no infinitive has been split before. I'm in favour of linguistic rules insofar as they aid understanding and are logical, but not when they're arbitrary and not even useful. I think it's difficult to strike a happy balance between preserving a language so that certain aspects of culture and heritage aren't completely lost, and accepting that the language is going to evolve according to how people use it. And there's not much you can do about that. France?
A person walking down the street just doesn't care. They're not that interested. They think it's fine to use anglicisms if they're in common use and if they get across the point. So there seems to be a real mismatch between what they're doing at the official level and the unofficial level. At the grassroots level, people aren't that bothered. I think a lot of reactions to anglicisms, it's a mask for a more broader cultural fear that France is being sidelined and that other countries, in particular the US, of course, are overtaking them on the global stage, which is true. And a lot of this fear about the French language being invaded by English is actually the reflection of the fear that France is losing its role in the world.
Oh, so it's got like penis anxiety, but about its own global status.
If you like to put it like that.
At least the Académie Française appears to be doing a pretty good job of marketing.
The influence of the Academy is, I think it's more to the imagination of French speakers that haven't had what you would call any tangible influence on the actual language itself. It just has had a really big influence on, you know, the idea of standard French and this kind of idea that speakers of French have, and that we as outsiders have as well, of French as being this very erudite, sophisticated, elegant language. They've had an influence on how French is imagined by French speakers, but not on how people actually speak French. You know, you have to question the point of going to that effort if you're not going to get those terms out to people. If your aim is really to replace the English term, you can't tell people how they should speak.
And as it turned out, they never even tried to tell English people how they officially should speak. The English Academy was never established.
There is a change of mood amongst English scholars. Everything that is French sort of gets rejected around the 18th century. It's a time of wars against the French, military wars, but also commercial wars, and the anti-Gallic sentiment increases amongst the scholars of the time. And in fact, the opposite happens. After 1715, there is a rejection of the idea of having an arbitrary, absolute authority deciding the correct way of speaking and writing English. The language changes. The language will change even if you try to fix it. And this is what they realise in the 18th century, actually.
A prime example of this was Samuel Johnson's dictionary, monumental in the history of English, as it was the first dictionary to attempt to catalogue the language comprehensively. A group of booksellers commissioned Johnson to write it, and starting off the project in 1746, he had grand plans.
He is full of ambition. He thinks he is going to fix the language for eternity. He will set down the rules that will remain the rules for everyone, in the same way as Latin was fixed because it was a dead language. But 10 years later, when the dictionary comes out, his discourse has changed completely, and he acknowledges that the language will change, will evolve, and there's nothing you can do about it. And it's for the better, because new need arise, new realities, new concepts need to be described. And the more you try to fix the language, the more it will resist until it's dead. And the only language that you can fix and have certain rules for are dead languages like Latin. Going back to the 18th century is an experience of of humility. And you see how those rules, which we now hold up as sacred, were actually very arbitrary and happened for completely random reasons. And it makes you feel a lot more relaxed about your own language when you read how they came about. And you don't have to feel so anxious about misspelling something or about ending a sentence with preposition or about using whom instead of who, for example. So you have to think of the language as something that is living, and it's living through the speakers and through the speakers' own idiosyncrasies.
I mean, languages change. That's what happens. They evolve. Creating an academy isn't going to stop that from happening.
In a way, the more standardized a language becomes, the more barren it becomes.
But attempts to fix the English language are still going on, as you'll discover in the next episode of The Allusionist. That's right, friends, we are double billing this. And I'll make double bill into a present participle if I want to. This episode was produced by me, Helen Zaltzman. Thanks a lot to Thomas Goddard, Liv Walsh, Rachela De Felice, and Martin Austwick, who makes the music for the show. Your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is toxophilite, noun, a student or lover of archery, adjective, of or relating to archers and archery. Try using it in an email today. You can email me via theallusionist.org, or you can Facebook or tweet me at allusionistshow, but I've noticed that a lot of you who do get in touch are very self-flagellating about your grammar. No need. As long as I can understand you, I really don't mind. I'm a pedant in recovery. Unless you use literally to mean the opposite of itself. No, let it go, Helen. It's too late. That is what the people want literally to mean.
But they've got other words for emphasis.
Just accept it. Semantic shift is unavoidable.